The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Cochran, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Zoom platform for the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our hearings today are July 15, 2021, and it will include three oral case presentations as well as the court consideration of non-oral case matters. The rules of appellate court do remain in place, even though you're appearing by Zoom, with the exception you do not have to stand if you feel more comfortable sitting down, depending on where your desk is or where you're logging in from. I want to remind you that you each have 15 minutes. The timer is in the upper left-hand corner, my left-hand corner, I assume is the same for you. If you have difficulty hearing or any communication issue, either wave your hand or speak up. I will also remind you to please state your name and also indicate the person or the entity you're appearing on behalf of before you begin your argument. So with that said, we'll turn first to, I'm sorry, I almost forgot to have the case called. I'll have Jack Fink, who is marshaling for us today, calling the first case for consideration.
Now calling case number 8210224, Lacey C. Washington versus State of Minnesota.
Appellant counsel, you have the floor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Janine Kimball, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of Appellant Minnesota Department of Corrections. And at this time, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
You are entitled to 5 minutes for rebuttal. You don't need to use all of that, but the time clock will show 5 minutes for the rebuttal period.
Thank you. This case involves a straightforward application of binding precedent that claims against the state for negligent supervision are barred as a matter of law. DOC respectfully requests this court reverse the district court's order denying DOC summary judgment on the negligent supervision claim. In this argument, I will focus my attention on the statutory immunity issue. If this issue prevails, it is dispositive of the appeal. Your Honors, DOC is entitled to statutory immunity as a matter of law on the negligent supervision claim. Under the Minnesota Tort Claims Act, the state is immune from suit where a loss is caused by the performance or failure to perform a discretionary duty, whether or not the discretion is abused. That's Minnesota Statutes, Section 3.736, Subdivision 3B. The supervision of employees is something that is quintessentially discretionary. Indeed, there is an unending line of cases in which this court and other courts have concluded that the supervision of employees is inherently discretionary. In a published Court of Appeals decision in 1997, the Gleason case, this court concluded, and I quote, "Claims for negligent supervision are based on policy level activity." In that case, it was a summary judgment case, and this court reversed the denial of summary judgment. This court reversed the denial of summary judgment in that case, although the court observed there was, quote, "a paucity of evidence in the record so early in litigation." That's at Penn Site 318. In other words, no facts were necessary for this court to determine as a matter of law in this published decision that negligent supervision claims are barred by statutory immunity.
Ms. Kimball, can I ask you a question? I see the judge in the district court order did address or cite the law, including the Gleason case that you're referring to, but it appeared to me that the court then went on to talk about foreseeability, and I didn't see an analysis of the actual immunity law, which I presume as a matter of law would need to be addressed before the issue of foreseeability, which would seem to go more towards the merits. Am I missing something, or is that how you would summarize the court's order as well?
That's how I read it as well, Your Honor. I'm not sure I would necessarily agree the statutory immunity issue needs to be addressed first, although it is dispositive. But yes, I read the district court's order as laying out the law and laying out what the party's arguments were, and then analyzing the entire claim on the foreseeability, which is a merit question and not an immunity question. That's how I read the district court's order, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that the reason, though, that the court denied summary judgment, because they said it was a question as far as foreseeability? I mean, you don't want to argue that, right?
The issue of foreseeability goes to an element of the claim of negligent supervision. Foreseeability is not relevant to whether the claim is barred as a matter of statutory immunity. The district court did not cite any cases for that proposition, neither did the parties. Instead, they're conceptually different questions. And so the only issue that appellant brings to the court today, because of the Gleason case having an opportunity for interlocutory appeal on immunity, the only issue before the court here is whether the district court erred when it failed to grant immunity to the Department of Corrections.
This question is, I'm going to ask, of course, respondent counsel this question, but from your perspective, if we agree and feel that statutory immunity should have been decided summarily in your favor, what's left of this case? Is there any pieces of the case left at all?
So the pieces that are left are the claims that are pending against Mr. Martin. And that is the former DOC employee. He was sued in this case. He has not appeared. I'm not aware of whether he's been served in this case, but that is the part of the case that will remain. Turning then to the second published decision that I wanted to discuss, it was just a year before the Gleason decision. This is the Oslin versus State decision from 1996. And again, in that case, this court stated decisions about supervision were necessarily entwined in a layer of policymaking that exceeded the mere application of rules to facts. The court separately reiterated the same notion that these issues of negligent supervision were, quote, necessarily beset with policymaking considerations. That case was also a summary judgment case, and this court affirmed dismissal on statutory immunity. I also want to direct the court's attention to the Fear case that was also published by this court in 2001. In that case, also a summary judgment case, this court reversed the district court and concluded the negligent supervision claim was barred under statutory immunity. And that case involved supervising school employees, and this court dismissed the negligent supervision claim related to supervising the employee who was a snowplow driver. I do notice one of the judges is unmuted. I just wanted to pause if there was a question. No. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball. Actually, I do have a question. This is Judge Cochran. Thank you for noticing that. So with regard to your argument on statutory immunity, does it matter if the supervision at issue relates to an operational or planning level policy decision? In other words, respondent argues that the transportation policy at issue is an operational level decision and therefore the immunity shouldn't apply.
So no, it doesn't for two reasons. So the first reason is because the, as a matter of law, negligent supervision claims are discretionary. And that's, again, the line of cases that I've discussed in addition to the additional cases that I was going to discuss. I would like to direct your court's attention to the Hawkinson case that is unpublished by this court. It was in 2006. And in that case, this court affirmed granting summary judgment on statutory immunity. The court didn't analyze the facts, didn't engage with the facts, concluded as a matter of law that negligent supervision claims were subject to statutory immunity. And the court observed, although the government entity usually has the burden to prove that it engaged in planning or policymaking activities that involved balanced social, political, or economic considerations in order to be entitled to immunity, this court observed that for negligent supervision claims, the government entity is entitled to immunity as a matter of law. Second, I just want to address, even if the court needed to engage in whether this particular action was operational or not, the record is clear from the Burmeister Declaration that setting the transportation policy is intertwined with balancing a variety of factors, including the staffing that is or isn't available for providing the policy that respondent argues was required. The fact that
you're referring to the transportation issue? when you're talking about the staffing. What about the one issue I am troubled with? It's a little bit different, but it's has to do with policymaking. What's your strongest argument as far as the failure to note that Martin didn't complete his yearly training and he was the performance review issue?
Sure. So there are three main arguments in addition to the general all negligent supervision claims are subject to statutory immunity. The second argument on that, Your Honor, is the fact that negligent training claims as a matter of law under the Johnson decision are not viable claims and respondents shouldn't be able to bootstrap what is essentially a negligent training claim into a negligent supervision claim. Moreover, there's nothing in the record, no facts showing that any difference in action with respect to monitoring training would have prevented the assaults at issue in this case. And I do just want to be clear, Your Honors, that it is relevant whether the challenged action would have had any impact on the tort. That's from the Oslin case. In Oslin, the court evaluated and concluded that as a matter of law, there were no facts indicating that a change in the nature of the report to the Department of Human Services would have prevented the conduct at issue in that case. And that will just take me 1 second. And that is not at my fingertips. It's not, I'm not finding the right part in my outline. I will come back to that just to cite the Oslin case for that. And then I think the final argument on that is the record shows that Mr. Odegaard did note in performance reviews that there was, that Mr. Martin had not completed all of the training. But I want to emphasize that it's not an issue of no training, right? Mr. Martin was trained multiple times not to have sexual contact with offenders. It also is against the law. And so the question isn't, did he never get the training? The question was about whether he got all of the refresher trainings, which we're going to reiterate that he's not allowed to have sexual contact with offenders. I also want to briefly mention the Eighth Circuit decision in the Parrish case, where the Eighth Circuit observed there's really no patently obvious need to train officers not to sexually assault offenders. And so here, there's just nothing in the record indicating that had Mr. Odegaard tracked the training differently, that there would have been any, that would have had any impact on whether Mr. Martin engaged in criminal conduct by sexually assaulting Ms. Washington. I want to turn the court's attention to the Gunick case, again, addressing a few of these, what I think are instructive unpublished decisions. That was from 2010. That case actually came to this court on a motion to dismiss, and the court affirmed dismissal on statutory immunity. In that case, the only alleged fact before this court at that time was the allegation in the complaint that the state had improperly supervised its employee and basically failed to prevent the tort, which is the same as the allegation here. And in that case, the court concluded it was proper for the district court to dismiss the negligent supervision claim on the motion to dismiss. I also referred already to the Hawkinson case from 2006. And then finally, there's a decision from the District of Minnesota, the Thompson case, that again was in the posture of a motion for summary judgment, but just like Hawkinson case, the District of Minnesota didn't engage in what the facts at issue were, instead just observed their interpretation of this court's line of cases and concluded as a matter of law that the conduct of supervising employees is discretionary. Respondent makes no attempt to distinguish those holdings from this case, and that's because they are not distinguishable and they require reversal. Indeed, respondent cites no case where a court has concluded statutory immunity does not apply to a negligent supervision claim. I want to emphasize a very important distinction between the Osland case and this case. In the Osland case, again, this court concluded that statutory immunity was appropriate as a matter of law. In this case, unlike Osland, there was zero indication that the former employee had engaged in or was engaging in any of these torts. There had been no reports related to respondent, related to Mr. Martin's conduct towards respondent or any other person. Respondent hangs her hat. I see that I have just a minute left. I just want to briefly address, I've already discussed the negligent training argument. I want to briefly address or direct the court's attention to, Your Honor asked a question about the transportation policy. I do just want to direct your attention to the Burmeister Declaration. That's document 58, which identifies the balancing that had to go into establishing the transportation policy. Your Honors, this court should follow its long line of cases and conclude the district court erred when it did not grant DOC summary judgment. I'm sorry, DOC immunity as a matter of law on the negligent supervision claim. DOC respectfully requests this court reverse the district court summary judgment order and remand, directing the district court to dismiss the negligent supervision claim. And I reserve the time that I have left. Thank you.
You'll have the 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Ms. Kimball. We'll turn now to you, Mr. Lederman, if I'm pronouncing that correct.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Zora Sub Lederman. I represent Ms. Washington. The court knows she's the plaintiff in this case, and the majority of this case against the state defendants was dismissed. What's left is this negligent supervision claim with respect to the state defendants, and that's why we're here on appeal.
And you got a very big burden to overcome the holding in Gleason. It's not addressed in your brief. How are you going to persuade us that we do not have precedent to follow?
I'll explain, Your Honor. So first of all, I think it's important to step back a little bit procedurally, because I heard a lot of arguments today from Ms. Kimball. I was watching the clock, about 4 minutes dealt with issues of causation, whether Mr. Odegaard's training could have made a difference. This is an appeal that focuses solely on the issue of immunity, Your Honor. And so we have to, number one, remember that if the district court made factual findings of any sort based on the summary judgment record, we cannot challenge or review those findings on this appeal. And if the district court made a determination that there are genuine issues of fact and dispute in this case, we again cannot review or challenge those findings here either. What the Department of Corrections can do in this appeal is argue that the district court improperly applied the immunity doctrines to its factual findings. But the underlying factual findings that the district court made, again, with respect to causation, whether it made a difference, the quality and the quantity of training that Mr. Martin had received, we cannot do anything with those findings here on this appeal. We have to assume them as true, because the only issue that can be appealed here in this appeal is whether the immunity law was properly applied to the district court's factual findings.
Would you agree that we review the immunity question de novo, that because it's a legal question?
I agree, Your Honor, that the immunity question is reviewed de novo, but I disagree that this court has the jurisdiction to reevaluate the district court's factual findings or to reevaluate the district court's decision that there are genuine issues of fact in dispute for trial. And the reason why it's important in this case is because immunity has to apply to a certain set of facts. We can't just apply immunity to the case generally without knowing what the facts are. And in order for us to decide whether the district court properly applied the immunity law to this case, we have to know what the facts are. And at the same time, we can't challenge those facts. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay, I'm not clear. What facts are in question that would preclude a summary judgment determination?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about next, Your Honor. So we have two facts that the district court decided warranted this case going to trial. The first one was Brad Odegaard's failure to properly supervise Mr. Martin. So the district court made a factual finding that that issue supported Ms. Washington's negligent supervision claim.
But if that is the case, even just let's flat out say that that supervision was remiss. We have Gleason. So how do we sidestep Gleason? It clearly says that these claims are supervision claims are entitled to statutory immunity. I mean, I think you need to get away from a supervisory type of claim.
Well, we try to get away, Your Honor, but all of that has been dismissed. So this is this is the only claim that's left. Your Honor, the way that we get away from Gleason is...
All right, so then I'm kind of jumping around now, but then that is my question. Is this, if we agree with appellant as far as the immunity issue, is that the death knell for your case? Is that kind of where this goes?
Well, it'll be the end of our case against the state defendants because there will not be any claims left. There will be appeal options with respect to other claims. But yes, this is the sole claim remaining against the DOC. And so if that gets dismissed, then the DOC will be out of this case completely. And Ms. Washington will be left to pursue her claims against Mr. Martin in his individual capacity. I want to go back to the questions regarding Gleason. And I think rather than focusing on the terminology in some of these cases that generally statutory immunity applies to negligent supervision claims, I think we should instead go back and see what the standard is for statutory immunity and then apply that standard to the district court's factual findings. And just to go back quickly, the second finding from district court was that sexual victimization of inmates during transports was a foreseeable risk of employment. So that was the second finding the district court made that established that Ms. Washington has the ability to try the negligent supervision claim if she can survive the immunity issue. And so applying the immunity doctrine to these two factual findings is what I think this appeal is about. And if we look at the first issue, the district court's finding that that Mr. Odegaard failed to properly supervise Mr. Martin, is that a planning level activity or is that an operational level activity? That's, in our view, the question that the court should be answering. Did he fail to perform a discretionary duty in his improper supervision of Mr. Martin, or did he fail to perform a ministerial duty? This is, again, issues that these immunity questions ask courts to consider. And I'll point out, as we explain in our briefing, Mr. Odegaard was actually reprimanded by the Department of Corrections for his failure to properly supervise Mr. Martin. And the reason for the reprimand was that he failed to follow the Department of Corrections policies and procedures in the way that he supervised Mr. Martin. So in our view, this is a clear example, number one, of a failure to perform a ministerial act. He had a ministerial duty to follow the guidelines and the DOC policies. He failed to do that. He was reprimanded for that by the DOC. This is a casebook example of his failure to perform a ministerial duty, and also casebook example of him engaging in operational level activity, which would not allow immunity to apply in this case. And then going
counsel,
to-
Respondent argues that with regard to that piece of your negligent supervision claim, that you're basically trying to turn a negligent training claim into a negligent supervision claim. Can you address that argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. First of all, we disagree with that with that characterization. The Department of Correction determined not that Mr. Odegaard failed to conduct proper training, but that he failed to properly supervise Mr. Martin based on Department of Corrections policies. And number two, going back to the comments I made earlier, we cannot review this finding in this appeal. The district court determined that that element was satisfied, that Mr. Odegaard's improper supervision of Mr. Martin supported Ms. Washington's negligent supervision claim. The Department of Corrections can seek to review this finding later on after trial. But this appeal is not the appropriate place to do that, because again, we're limited to reviewing the district court's application of immunity law rather than the district court's application of the substantive law and deciding whether there is a fact issue for trial in this case. The second finding—
Did the district court actually analyze or apply the immunity law here? Do you read the district court's order as doing that?
Your Honor, I would agree that the district court order doesn't go into any great depth about how it came to its conclusion. But I would also note the district court did set out the essential elements of the immunity doctrines. And it did conclude in its order that the Department of Corrections is not entitled to immunity based on the proper law that it set out. So I don't see a district court misapplying the law. The district court perhaps didn't provide much detail about how it reached its conclusion, but ultimately we have the correct law. We do have a definite statement by the district court that immunity would not apply. Turning to the second finding of the district court, the issue of foreseeability, that this is the second finding the district court made when it decided that number one, the negligent supervision claim would go forward and that immunity doesn't apply. The issue here is whether the Department of Corrections adequately responded to the risk of sexual victimization of female inmates during transports. And the Department of Corrections argues that whatever that response should be or could be, that that's a planning level decision. And our position is that this is an operational level decision that pertains to daily operation of Department of Corrections staff and daily operation of Department of Corrections inmates. Now, the issue that I see Department of Corrections raising is that there's a kind of a financial or economic component that, of course, if we are going to require two officers to transport all of the inmates instead of one, that will have a financial impact on the state because we're going to use more tax money to pay for additional officers. But if we do that, Your Honors, then if we kind of paint it in that broad of a stroke, then any decision by the government is going to become a planning level decision because everything the government does costs money. And if we're going to make that as a sole consideration, then we're not going to have any sort of operational level activity. And the case law makes clear that there is such a concept as operational level activity, even though there doesn't seem to be much case law reaching that conclusion with respect to any individual case, but the concept is there. And our view is that this decision by the Department of Corrections in this case, not to take any sort of action or response after finding out that there is a risk of sexual victimization of inmates, that's an operational level of determination. It doesn't apply to the public in general. It's not a public policy consideration where we have to weigh the interests of the inmates versus the people on the outside. This is a decision that simply pertains to, are we going to have one or two officers during each transport to reduce the risk of female inmates being sexually abused by male correctional staff. And in our view, despite the fact that there is, of course, a financial component to the decision, this still remains an operational level decision. Case law also talks about planning level decisions having to do with public policy considerations. What is the public policy consideration in deciding if we're going to have one or two officers to transport female inmates between facilities or to do work services while they're incarcerated? So the district court's decision that this foreseeability issue and the Department of Corrections' failure to act was an operational level decision, in our view, was correct. And so based on that, it appears that district court did, number one, properly set out the law. The district court made factual findings supporting Ms. Washington's negligent supervision claim, and the district court properly decided that based on those factual findings, statutory immunity would not apply in this case. And so for those reasons, Your Honors, yes, sorry.
Can you point us to any case where an appellate case where the court has held that statutory immunity does not apply to a negligent supervision claim?
Your Honor, Conlon versus City of St. Paul, I believe is such a case. I don't believe this is a case cited 605 Northwest 2nd 396. I believe that was a case where the decision was made that immunity would not apply. But I agree, Your Honor, that the case law, there is a lot more case law out there supporting this general proposition that immunity should apply in various contexts. But again, I would ask the court to look at the facts of this case. I would ask the court to focus the analysis in this case, not on whether the negligent supervision claim is supported, but on whether the district court's factual findings are properly applied to the immunity law. Based on those arguments, Your Honors, we would ask that the Court of Appeals affirm the district court's findings.
Thank you, Mr. Lederman. We'll turn back to you now, Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Your Honors. I did just look at briefly the Collin case. On my first review, it does not appear that is a negligent supervision case. Perhaps it may be a case where the court concluded immunity did not apply, but that I don't see that it is a negligent supervision claim case. Obviously, I have not had time to review it. But I just want to briefly reiterate the DOC's argument that there's no fact indicating the record doesn't reflect that any change in action by Mr. Odegaard would have had any impact on the sexual assaults that occurred here. And again, I wanted I found the citation for the citation to the Oslin case. The pin site is 416. And in the Oslin case, in the context of statutory immunity, this court discussed and observed that the record in that case was inadequate as a matter of law to show that the alleged retaliation would not have occurred if more detailed information had been furnished to the Department of Human Services. So in that case, this court observed the conduct that was being challenged. They're like, you said, you know, as a matter of law, there's nothing in the record indicating this would have made any difference. And this court made that observation in the context of the statutory immunity analysis. I'd like to directly respond to some of the arguments by respondent related to factual findings. The district court did not make factual findings. This was a summary judgment record. The court had to review the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. There weren't factual findings. This court questioned respondent and respondent acknowledged this court reviews this decision on a de novo basis. At the most, what the court concluded was there was a fact issue on foreseeability. That's what the court concluded. The court didn't make factual findings that then are the law of the case or things that this court can't review. The posture of this case is whether the court erred as a matter of law as to immunity, and there aren't factual findings that were made that affect this court's analysis. And as I've argued today and in the briefing, because it is a matter of law in any event, there wouldn't be any need for a factual record to conclude the negligent supervision claim is barred as a matter of statutory immunity. I do want to respond also to respondent's argument that the supervisor, Mr. Odegaard, was reprimanded in connection with his supervision of Mr. Martin. That does not change the analysis here. Whether or not he was reprimanded does not affect whether or not his conduct was ministerial or not. There certainly are circumstances, I imagine, when employees and officials engage in discretionary conduct, and yet the entity decides you did not exercise your discretion appropriately, and we're going to discipline you. So it's not simply because he was reprimanded does not answer the question about whether immunity applies, certainly does not answer the question about whether Gleason applies and should control here, that negligent supervision claims are barred as a matter of law under statutory immunity. Finally, I just
Kimball,
wanted to
Ms. Kimball, can I just jump back to Auslan? Am I understanding your client's argument, just to be clear here, that the Gleason case more properly cites the law, the reference to the, I'll call it a but-for analysis that Auslan reviewed, would you define that more as dicta? And you were citing other unpublished decisions subsequent to both of them as well, which would suggest the negligent supervision essentially ends the analysis based on the Gleason holding.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not understand your question. What was your question about what was dicta out of Auslan?
You were referencing that there's no evidence in the record. Auslan was identifying that any supervision would have changed the result or anything that was missing. But I had understand your earlier points to be focusing purely on the Gleason proposition, negligent supervision is not ministerial. It's discretionary. And that essentially ends the analysis. Did I summarize that?
I agree. Yes. Thank you. I was arguing the alternative. Yes. Yes, that I think Gleason properly states the law that as a matter of law, negligent supervision claims are subject to statutory immunity. I did not have any additional arguments, and so I'll just reiterate DOC's request that this court reverse and remand and direct the district court to enter summary judgment in the DOC's favor.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing on the Zoom platform. The arguments are helpful, and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe.